couple of quick housekeeping details. There is, if you would like it, there'll be the option of taking a final exam, which I'm going to finish writing tonight or tomorrow. I'm going to send it to Danny again tonight or tomorrow. It should be available sometime early next week. Taking it, obviously, you can do that at your leisure. I can close it whenever. I'll refer to Danny on when we should close the exam. It's going to be a rather long exam. I'm aiming for 100 questions. I'm at about 85 so far, and sort of no matter what, I'm going to curve it so that the average on the exam is at least 75. This being the first time I've taught a class like this, it'll be interesting to see how the exam itself actually goes. Like I said, I'll curve it to an average of 75. I'll write something about a grading scale before too terribly long. And those of you who are taking this for credit somewhere else, either via homeschool or another institution might be giving you independent study credit or something like that, let me know if there's anything that I need to do for you. So yeah, look for the exam. This will be our last meeting. And before we get going, I want to say a brief word about our sponsors. I bought a box full of copies of the new pocket edition of Human Action to give away as gifts. And I have to be honest, I'm absolutely amazed at the quality of these things. This is the print is, I think the pages are something like 80% of the size of the pages in the Scholar's Edition. And you can tell this fits, it's pocket-sized. Like I said, I'm completely blown away with just how unbelievably good this is. And if you really want a solid and long-lasting exposure to the economics of capitalism and socialism, I would encourage you, of course, to look up, read, obviously read Human Action at some point, and the new Pocket Edition gives you something you can basically carry anywhere you want to go for $10 plus shipping, or with a slight discount if you order more. That's, again, not to be too hagiographic, I guess, that's actually one of the reasons why I enjoy working with the Mises Institute, is that they do so much to distribute the ideas and make them very, very, very cheap. So we have, over the course of four lectures, over the course of four periods together, discussed the nature of economic calculation in the socialist commonwealth. We've discussed the differences between capitalism and socialism. We've defined our terms. We've talked about cultural and environmental critiques of capitalism. And tonight we're going to round this out by discussing the persistence of the popularity of interventionism, something I don't at times fully understand, because I think it's fairly clear the theory and evidence are obviously on the side of free market capitalism. And what we're going to explore a little bit tonight is why exactly interventionism remains as popular as it does, in spite of the fact that, again, I think the overwhelming bulk of theory and evidence is on the side of liberty. So what we're going to talk about a little bit tonight will be the goals of a capitalist order, the goals, or at least the stated goals, of a socialist order, how exactly it is that the intellectuals, and this is a class that's discussed by Hayek, and a class that is also discussed by Thomas Sowell in his 2009 book, Intellectuals in Society, which, you know, as long as I'm playing show and tell with books, that's here. I'm reviewing it for a journal called Economic Affairs, which is published by the Institute of Economic Affairs in London. This is a class of people who, in large part, are responsible for public opinion, and so we'll talk about why exactly it is that they remain, in part, on the side of socialism. And then when we're finished with the lecture part of this, I'm going to open it up for questions, and I'm happy to talk about pretty much anything you want me to talk about between when I finish my straightforward lecturing and whenever 7:30 rolls around. So, one of my favorite quotes in all of economics comes from Adam Smith, and it's not from The Wealth of Nations, as people might expect. It's from his first book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments. Again, another book I would encourage everyone to pick up. I would show you my copy, except it's on the bookcase on the other side of the room. Smith describes and discusses a character in his moral philosophy and a character in his social theory that he calls the man of system. Smith describes, and I quote, "The man of system, on the contrary, is apt to be very wise in his own conceit, and is often so enamored with the supposed beauty of his own ideal plan of government that he cannot suffer the smallest deviation from any part of it. He goes on to establish it completely and in all its parts without any regard either to the great interests or to the strong prejudices which may oppose it. He seems to imagine that he can arrange the different members of a great society with as much ease as the hand arranges the different pieces upon a chessboard. He does not consider that the pieces upon the chessboard have no other principle of motion besides that which the hand impresses upon them, but that, in the great chessboard of human society, every single piece has a principle of motion of its own, altogether different from that which the legislature might choose to impress upon it. If those two principles coincide and act in the same direction, the game of human society will go on easily and harmoniously, and is very likely to be happy and successful. If they are opposite or different, the game will go on miserably, and the society must be at all times in the highest degree of disorder." So Smith, as a social theorist, offered a whole lot that influenced the early and late Austrians, and in particular, you can see the influence of Smith working itself out on Hayek's social theory as he develops it, in large part after he writes The Use of Knowledge in Society in the mid-1940s. So Smith discusses the man of system. Let's unpack exactly who this character, the man of system, is. So the man of system has a handful of characteristics. First, the man of system is apt to be very wise in his own conceit. So it's fairly obvious that the man of system thinks very, very highly of his, or we could have a woman of system today, her abilities, and is often so enamored with supposed beauty of his own ideal plan of government. Second, the man of system is, in addition to being very wise in his own conceit and, let's say, flattered with his or her own ability, is also taken, in a sense, with an idea of what a great future could look like, of an idea of what a perfect society could look like. If only I were in charge, if only I were allowed to plan a beautiful society, then everything would be great, and everything would be wonderful. And I would have, you know, just all these wonderful and great ideas for everyone. You might remember, I think, Hillary Clinton in the run-up to the 2008 election said that she has so many opportunities for the United States. She wants so badly to be president. I mean, she even broke down in tears talking about how badly she wanted to be president. So she typified, in a sense, the woman of system. So first, the man of system is flattered by his own abilities. Second, enraptured by his own vision of what a great society would look like. And then third, sort of detached from social reality, in that the man of system can't understand how or why anybody would want to do anything other than what he or she chooses for that person to do. One of the ideas that is evident in Smith's passage on the man of system is that there is a one right way to organize society, and that the goal of social organization, or the goal of anyone who is doing the governing, should be to identify that one right way and push people in that direction. One of the most interesting things about this passage in Smith is where Smith says he does not, referring to the man of system, says he does not consider that the pieces upon the chessboard have no other principle of motion besides that which the hand impresses upon them, but that in the great chessboard of human society, every single piece has a principle of motion of its own, altogether different from that which the legislature might choose to impress upon it. So you see here in Smith's discussion of the man of system, the law of unintended consequences. Make sure I write this down. So you see in Smith's passage on the man of system, the law of unintended consequences, because people are not, the man of system is not really even conceiving of a world in which people have a principle of motion apart from that which the legislature chooses to do. According to the man of system, there can be no meaningful, or there could be no real difference between that which is best for the individual and that which is best for the collective. In other words, that which is good for each is necessarily that which is good for all, and in turn, that which is good for all is also that which is good for each, because that is what's necessary to create a great society. The unintended consequences, as we've explored, have been absolutely disastrous. A couple of years ago, I spoke as part of a panel at Rhodes on what's wrong with the world. And I talked about kind of precisely this sort of issue. And I exhorted my students to not be that guy. Don't be the man of system. Don't try to be the woman of system. Don't try to think that you can plan a great society, that you can plan the lives of others, because quite simply, you can't. That's one of the things that is an implication of basic economics, is that if you try to plan things centrally, you get, ultimately, a chaos that is worse than the anarchy of production you're trying to replace with your wise and benevolent planning. So what is the goal of socialism? So often people apologize for socialism, or they view socialism as a moral ideal. Like we talked about last time, there are a handful of different ways that we can think about socialism. Lord Acton's view of socialism is that, well, it's corrupted by the fact that the powerful are the ones who get on top. Hayek's view of socialism is the view, no, excuse me, Acton's view is that power corrupts. Acton said power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Hayek's view is that it was structured in such a way as to make sure that the worst people were the ones who got on top. Brian Kaplan and Eugene Richter were the ones who argued that it was born corrupt to begin with. The people who espoused socialism from the very outset were espousing socialism because their ideal was a totalitarian society in which they were ultimately in charge of everything. These were not idealists gone wrong. These were people whose ideal was, in part perhaps, the type of tyranny that we saw in the 20th century. But nonetheless, people latch on to socialism because they think it's a way of imagining a great society. You know, socialism is a world in which true beauty is respected and rewarded. Socialism is a world in which intellectuals are respected and rewarded, in which people who do the kind of work that I do, which is to write studies on economic subjects and teach about economic subjects, we obviously don't get our full due from a capitalist society. So what we need is some sort of alternative that will recognize and reward us for the full fruits of our great contribution to the great conversation, which will ultimately produce the great society. So socialism is beautiful. It's supposed to be a world in which we overcome self-interest. As Marx said, communism is the positive transcendence of private property as human self-alienation. So we transcend all of the things that ruin our lives, all of the things that fundamentally make us less than human as a result of the capitalist mode of production. We recapture our full humanity, and we live in what is in a sense, a Marxist or socialist vision of the millennium. So we live at some point past the point where the revolution comes in a world where we have transcended private property as self-alienation. We've transcended self-interest, we've transcended the principle that people respond to incentives, and everybody does everything for the benefit of great society, not for the benefit of themselves, but because it is the right thing to do. One of the problems of socialism, or one of the questions that people raised, was, okay, well, who's going to take out the trash under socialism? And I think we've discussed this a little bit before. But yeah, this was a serious problem. Who takes out the trash under socialism? Who does the unpleasant jobs? And the argument of the socialists is, well, after the revolution, after the transition to socialism, we restore our full humanity. We begin to work as man, and we begin to transcend such base considerations as incentives, such base considerations as the risks associated with or the rewards for our actions. We transcend the kinds of things that frame a modern-day political economy, and we help to create a great and wonderful world. So that in part is the goal of socialism, to create a beautiful world. And this is part of its attraction. Is allegedly it has this vision of an ideal, this vision of an ideal and perfect world in which we have no problems anymore. We have no more war. We have no more possessions. We have no more conflict, and so on and so forth. This is contrasted with the goal of capitalism, which is to produce a better Triscuit, a rosemary and olive oil Triscuit, to sell it on, to sell it in quantities of 12 on Amazon.com using Subscribe and Save. The goals of capitalism are base, and the goals of capitalism are fundamentally immoral. One could also argue that the goals of capitalism are fundamentally dehumanizing. We use, in a capitalist system, one another as mere means to our chosen ends. We don't view other human beings as mere ends as ends unto themselves. And in the process, what we do is we create a system whereby we are alienated not merely from the fruits of our labor, but we're also alienated from one another as human beings. We're alienated from our species essence. We're alienated from our species essence because we're viewing one another as mere means to our ends, and we're engaged in trivial tasks and in endeavors that are not going to ring out through eternity as great, wonderful endeavors that created a great and wonderful society. We do things like try to produce better Triscuits, which is the problem of technology, in part, and then we try to foist them upon a populace that does not want them or does not need them or would not buy them without a lot of clever advertising. So part of the attractiveness of socialism to the intellectuals, and also part of the attractiveness of socialism to everyone else, is this idea that socialism has as its view this great society and this world in which everybody's happy and in which everybody's rights are respected, whereas capitalism has at best base motivations like producing better snack crackers for people who don't want them and don't need them, which we will then try to sell to people using advertising and using the manipulation of their minds and the manipulation of their preferences. Another one of the reasons why socialism is popular and why interventionism is popular very specifically is that it flatters the conceit of Smith's man of system. It flatters the intelligence and the self-importance of the intellectuals. Because under an interventionist system, what we have is a world in which, well, obviously, if we're going to have a society that functions, it's going to require input from intellectuals, and it's going to require input from the man and woman of system. Society cannot function, according to the socialist or according to the interventionist, without the input and the direction of moral, intellectual, and cultural superiors. So when we try to develop a view of socialism or a view of interventionism and try to explain why it is popular even in spite of the evidence, these are a handful of things that might help us to explain it. First, it looks beautiful. You know, it looks like there are wonderful, wonderful goals associated with the development of a socialist society and with the socialization of the means of production and with everyone living as comrades. Second, the status quo, or what we at least call capitalism, seems pointless and meaningless. And indeed, it is true that there is no meaning necessarily attaching to a capitalist economic system. There's no meaning that we can attach to a world of private property ownership and voluntary exchange. Why is that? Because trade itself is in the service of individual means and individual ends, while socialism is allegedly in the service of the development of a great society unto itself. So socialism is a system with a purpose, whereas capitalism appears to be a system without a purpose. Third, one of the reasons why socialism remains popular, and especially one of the reasons why it remains popular among intellectuals and among the intelligentsia, is because it flatters the conceit of the man of system. It flatters the conceit of the man of system in that it suggests that intellectuals, moral superiors, cultural superiors, political superiors are necessary for the functioning of society. The society would disintegrate, or society would be something less than it could otherwise be in the absence of the intervention of the intellectuals. Okay. So let's go to Mises. Mises in Socialism offers a discussion of the kinds of problems that people look at, and the ways that people analyze societies. And he writes as follows: scarcely anyone interests himself in social problems without being led to do so by the desire to see reforms enacted. Parenthetically, I'll say that, yeah, that's one of the reasons why I do what I do, why I interest myself in social problems. It's because I want to see reforms enacted. That's become very instrumentally important as we've had children in the last few years. Picking up with Mises again, he writes, in almost all cases, before anyone begins to study the science, he has already decided on definite reforms that he wants to put through. Only a few have the strength to accept the knowledge that these reforms are impracticable and to draw all the inferences from it. Most men endure the sacrifice of the intellect more easily than the sacrifice of their daydreams. They cannot bear that their utopias should run aground on the unalterable necessities of human existence. What they yearn for is another reality different from the one given in this world. They long for the leap of humanity out of the realm of necessity and into the realm of freedom. They wish to be free of a universe of whose order they do not approve. That, I think, is one of the more interesting passages in all of Mises, because he nails a lot of important things. We analyze policy, and we talk about ideas because we want to see reforms enacted. We want to see the world in which we live look better. We want to see the world in which we live perform better. We want to see justice. We want to see efficiency. We want the world in which our children grow up to be a world that we can be proud of, quite honestly. But often, according to Mises, people are willing to cling to their visions of how they think the world should be, in spite of evidence, because they want so badly to cling to those visions that they are indeed willing at times to ignore evidence suggesting that vision might fail. Okay. So let's consider a couple of examples, and then we'll consider an explanation. Econ 100, or in any introductory economics class, is going to have as its set of standbys examples of applied supply and demand analysis, or the analysis of international trade, where we will show that a policy like the minimum wage not merely creates economic inefficiency, it actually hurts precisely the people that the policy is allegedly enacted to help. Minimum wages hurt not just the people who are paying the wages, but also the people to whom the wages would be paid. It eliminates job opportunities, it creates additional unemployment, and over the very, very long run, it increases poverty. Price controls are another perfect example of this. If you've been following the news at all, you know about the tornadoes that ripped through parts of Alabama and left the town in which I went to college, Tuscaloosa, staggered, quite honestly. I checked yesterday, and the Attorney General of the state of Alabama has said that the governor's declaration of an emergency means that the state's price gouging statute is now in effect. So basically, we now have price controls. This is the second type of intervention, for which straightforward basic introductory economics shows that not only does this hurt the sellers of the goods subject to the price control, it also hurts the people who allegedly need the stuff so badly. So price controls create shortages. Both of these are examples of the law of unintended consequences. Minimum wages and legal minimum prices create unemployment or create unsellable surpluses of the goods that are subject to a minimum price or to a price floor. And maximum prices, like rent control or like price gouging statutes, create shortages of the stuff that people really, really want or really, really need to buy. People criticize exchange for a lot of different reasons. So a third type of interventionism that creates drastically, perhaps unintended, or we like to think unintended, but nonetheless disastrous consequences, is protectionism, or anything aimed at restricting free trade between countries, free trade between states in the U.S., or free trade between individuals. The path to prosperity does not run through protection, and indeed, this is something that is very, very straightforward and is a staple of any introductory economics class. Restricting international trade impoverishes people because, according to the law of comparative advantage, we can get things more cheaply if we can buy them from people who have a comparative advantage in it, and we earn higher incomes by selling whatever it is we happen to have a comparative advantage in. I tell my students all the time that economics helps us to define the non-negotiable constraints on social reality. Things like the law of demand, the law of supply, the law of comparative advantage, we call these laws because they're pretty much as close as economics is going to get to the law of gravity in physics. These are things that are non-negotiable. If you're going to make any kind of policy or analyze any kind of policy, you have to grapple with these kinds of issues. So according to Mises, what's happening here is a lot of times the people who are apologizing for socialism or who are dreaming up newer, better interventions is basically it's fundamentally a type of social criticism where they're criticizing an order of which they do not approve, and at the same time leaping to the assumption that they can make things better. So in considering some of the things that Mises is talking about here, we have the law of unintended consequences. We have a logical leap from I don't like this world to I can make the world better. And then finally, we want to think a little bit about how exactly it is and why exactly it is that people don't update their beliefs in the face of information and in the face of available evidence. Let me see if that's the next slide here. Yeah, so why the apparent immunity to evidence among interventionists? It's something that quite honestly I find a little bit frustrating. The more I do, the more I teach, the more I write, the more that I give public lectures, is how Henry Hazlitt was exactly right, that the good ideas have to be relearned every single generation. Law of demand, law of supply, law of comparative advantage, the same fallacies keep coming up. The same fallacies keep having to be beaten down with basic economics. And one of the things that's interesting is that a lot of times these same fallacies tend to appear and persist through the same classes of intellectuals from generation to generation, and indeed even the same people who will cling to ideas like, for example, that we're going to run out of natural resources, or that socialism is beautiful, in spite of incredible amounts of evidence. Hayek is great on this. In Intellectuals and Socialism, he discusses very specifically, in some cases, how exactly it is that people come to be enthusiasts for socialism and why they're resistant to. Okay, so first of all, Hayek argues, and I quote, "The first point here, which those who do not share this bias ought to face frankly, is that it is neither selfish interests nor evil intents, but mostly honest convictions and good intentions which determine the intellectual's views," end quote. So on one hand, they mean well, or at least we like to think that they mean well. And they are given to habits of abstract thought. Again, this is from Hayek. They're given to habits of abstract thought that are generally not very common among the populace, and they tend from this to extract a certain conceit, suggesting that they, with good intentions and with habits of abstract thought, are in a best position to organize and design society. Hayek also points out that there are social constraints on the ideas that we develop. Because you know, the people that you're around are going to tend at times to act as an echo chamber of sorts. They're going to tend to confirm your biases. They're going to tend to reinforce some of the intellectual errors you might be committing. And then also, and here I borrow from Brian Kaplan. If you haven't read his 2007 book, The Myth of the Rational Voter, I encourage you to do so. Kaplan develops an idea that he calls rational irrationality. Basically, having irrational beliefs can be costless at times, and changing from irrational beliefs to rational beliefs can, in fact, be costly. So, being a protectionist might win you friends in certain circles, you know, people who think that, you know, foreigners are going to take all of our jobs or something like that. And then updating your beliefs, really learning something about economics, is likely to be extremely difficult. It requires a heavy investment of time, a heavy investment of energy, a heavy investment of intellectual capacity, and it doesn't really bring you a whole lot in terms of increasing your social network, you know, because who wants to be friends with economists, after all? And also, it's not really going to do a whole lot to influence policy. So you're going to have, as a result of this, so you're going to have, as a result of the fact that it's almost all cost and no benefit necessarily to change irrational beliefs, people clinging, in fact, to irrational beliefs, oftentimes about economics and about economic systems. And the note here that I made as I was reading Hayek and as I was reading a handful of other things, again, anyone in the audience who is a student who's looking for a project to work on, it's become clear to me the more that I read, and a large part of this comes from following Robin Hanson's blog, Overcoming Bias, which I highly recommend, that people are very, very good at rationalizing things that they want to believe already, and they're not very good at conducting independent examinations of evidence. So we're very, very good at latching onto something we want to believe and finding propositions to support whatever it is that we want to believe. We're not very good at all at we're not very good at all at actually engaging in detailed examinations of the propositions we believe using solid theory and sound evidence. What about the incentives of the intellectuals? One of my favorite thinkers and writers is Thomas Sowell. His 2007, well, I think the first version of A Conflict of Visions was published in 1987. He updated it and published a new version in 2007. His book, A Conflict of Visions, is one of the better pieces of social science I've ever read. It was recommended to me by a senior colleague not terribly long after I started at Rhodes. I've assigned it in my introductory econ classes. I didn't do that this semester, but I'm planning to do it again starting next year just because it honestly is so good. It derives a lot from Adam Smith, it derives a lot from Friedrich Hayek, and in it, Sowell describes what he calls the constrained vision and the unconstrained vision. The elements of the constrained vision and the unconstrained vision deal primarily with human nature. Specifically, the constrained vision says, hey, look, people respond to incentives, people are basically fundamentally self-interested. These are things that are taken as given by scholars like Friedrich Hayek and scholars like Adam Smith. The unconstrained vision says that people are malleable, that we can change people, that we can make them no longer respond to incentives, we can make them no longer greedy, we can make them perfect. People are perfectible, according to the unconstrained vision, and it is the job of the intellectuals and the job of society to mold people into the stuff that makes for true greatness. Sowell's book, The Vision of the Anointed, is in part kind of an empirical examination of some of these things. In it, he refers to the tragic vision, which in a sense is basically the same thing as the constrained vision. The Vision of the Anointed has the best subtitle I have ever seen on any book. The subtitle is Self-Congratulation as a Basis for Social Policy. What Sowell establishes in the Vision of the Anointed, which he contrasts to the Vision of the Benighted, is the evidence-free social theory that goes on primarily among people on the left who come up with ideas about how they want society to be organized, implement these, and then still find them desirable irrespective of the available evidence. In The Quest for Cosmic Justice, he discusses, much as Hayek does, in the second volume of Law, Legislation, and Liberty, which is titled The Mirage of Social Justice, he looks for some idea of cosmic justice and argues that it cannot exist, that it's not something that can be implemented on this world or in this life. And then finally, in Intellectuals in Society, which was published a couple of years ago, he discusses much more deeply, and he ties a lot of these things together. He discusses much more deeply the incentives faced by intellectuals. Intellectuals in Society, according to Sowell, is kind of the third part of a trilogy of sorts that started with Paul Johnson's book, Intellectuals, published, I think, in 1988. Something like a decade later, Richard Posner published a book called Public Intellectuals that dealt with public intellectuals, people who do intellectual work outside of the academy, or intellectual work for public consumption. And then Sowell is looking for the social effects of intellectuals and is attempting to explain the kinds of incentives that intellectuals face. Most fundamentally, according to Sowell, the chief problem with intellectuals, and one of the reasons why they are not terribly quick to update their ideas, is that they do not bear any cost associated with implementing a disastrous scheme that, say in the case of socialism in the 20th century, killed tens to hundreds of millions of people, or implementing a social policy that has disastrous unintended consequences. They're shielded from and insulated from the consequences of their schemes, and therefore do not have the kinds of incentives that we would like to see people have to update their beliefs, to dispatch error, and to get rid of the pieces of their cognitive architecture that are making them fundamentally misunderstand society. Sowell juxtaposes this against the kinds of incentives that are faced by entrepreneurs in a profit and loss capitalist society. If you don't produce something people want at a price they're willing to pay, then you lose money. That's the market's way of slapping you around, in a sense, and showing you that you're wasting resources. Example I've used before, imagine sauerkraut and salmon smoothies. These sound horrific. Salmon might be valuable in one respect. Sauerkraut might be valuable in another respect. Combining the two, these are not what I would think would be great taste that taste great together. The profit and loss mechanism of the market is going to slap around any entrepreneur who tries to implement such a thing and say, we'll say to them, you're taking valuable resources, salmon, sauerkraut, blenders, etc., and you're using them to produce something that is less valuable than those resources would be in any other line of occupation. Profits and losses in the market provide people with incentives to update their mental models of how the world actually works, because they literally have some skin in the game. They have something riding on every decision they make and the outcomes of the exchanges into which they enter. The incentives are weaker in a sense than something like team sports, because you get immediate feedback in sports on whether a certain play worked or whether a certain play didn't work. You can use statistics to figure out whether this play worked or that play worked or the other thing, and you're going to get really, really reliable feedback on whether your schemes are conducive to winning the game or not. Politics, the incentives are much, 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 much weaker. At the very least, we can say, well, we can vote out the bums who are making lots of policies. That's unlikely to work for a lot of different reasons, because people tend to grab onto lousy ideas. Farm subsidies would be a perfect example of this. A lot of people think that farm subsidies are a great idea. And indeed, even in non-farm states, farm subsidies are very, very popular. But nonetheless, there exists at least some kind of feedback mechanism in a political system, and particularly in a democratic political system, that might prevent politicians from doing things that are as dumb as they would do if they were unconstrained. In the case of intellectuals and ideas, the feedback mechanisms sometimes are a lot more opaque. When you're publishing work in scientific journals, it generally is going to be reviewed by your peers. So you're going to have peer review, where if you submit a journal or an article to a refereed journal, it's going to be reviewed by two people who don't know who you are, and you're not going to know who they are. They're going to send reports to the editor. They're going to say the paper's great, or the paper's lousy, or the paper needs to be revised. There's feedback in this kind of thing. But in the overall intellectual arena, in the marketplace for ideas, the intellectual, as what Hayek called a secondhand dealer in ideas, faces relatively little feedback. I can advocate all sorts of silly policies, and maybe some people might stop listening to me. Other people might start. I can advocate all sorts of policies that hurt all sorts of people, but I am fundamentally insulated from the consequences of the policies that I'm advocating, and therefore I bear no risk, no real risk, from advocating lousy policies. I get no meaningful feedback for advocating lousy policies. And in this sense, my incentive to update my mental models of how the world works and to adapt myself to mental models that are more consistent with reality is going to be relatively diminished. So what do we do about it? It's a very tough question, and one that often, quite honestly, we can think about how exactly we as sort of, I'm an intellectual. I have all sorts of ideas, some of which are probably silly. I like to think that given that I'm an expert in economics, I deserve to be listened to on that front. Other things in which I'm not an expert, like particle physics, maybe not so much. But we have kind of a grim scenario where the intellectuals, according to Friedrich Hayek, are the ones who shape public opinion. Public opinion ultimately influences public policy, and public policy influences human welfare. If we know that people are going to have lousy incentives, and if we know that people are going to indulge silly ideas, even at the expense of everybody else, well, it's not at all clear what, if anything, we can do about that. Again, though, here, I'm going to go to Mises. And those of you who don't really know that much about Mises, I'm pretty sure I've mentioned this before. Mises predicted the Great Depression. He was offered a job at one of the most important banks in the world in the 1920s. And he said, yeah, no, this is all going to hell in a handbasket. I don't want to be any part of it. He predicted the Great Depression and turned down a job with a great bank based on his correct prediction. For his effort, he was chased out of Europe by the Nazis in the 1940s. He ended up in the United States. And indeed, I'm completely of the opinion that the Nazis would have gassed him or something like that if they'd gotten their hands on him. He ended up in the United States and did some very, very important work, including specifically Human Action, which was published in 1949. So a couple of years after the Nazis, Mises has spent a good chunk of his career. He was born in 1881. So by this point, he's, what, in his late 60s, I believe. Publishes Human... I'm blanking on this completely. So 1949, it would have been in his late 60s. He spent his entire adult life fighting an intellectual battle over socialism and liberalism. He gets to the United States penniless, having been chased out of Europe by the Nazis, and nonetheless proceeds to write what is probably the greatest contribution to social science of the last 100 years, that being specifically Human Action. So here's Mises, and this will be the last quote of the evening. He writes, "The public discussion of economic problems ignores almost entirely all that has been said by economists in the last 200 years. Prices, wage rates, interest rates, and profits are dealt with as if their determination were not subject to any law. Governments try to decree and to enforce maximum commodity prices and minimum wage rates. Statesmen exhort businessmen to cut down profits, to lower prices, and to raise wage rates as if these were dependent on the laudable intentions of individuals. In the treatment of international economic relations, people blithely resort to the most naive fallacies of mercantilism. Few are aware of the shortcomings of all these popular doctrines, or realize why the policies based upon them invariably spread disaster." Pause there for just a second. A lot of people just flat don't realize that the policies that they support, that they think are such great ideas, lead to humanitarian disasters. Big parts of that are the fact that people make decisions on the basis of emotion rather than reason, and developing a solid command of economics is very, very difficult to do. Here's Mises, though. He writes, "These are sad facts. However, there's only one way in which a man can respond to them: by never relaxing in the search for truth." Let's put this in big and bold. Mises writes, "These are sad facts. However, there's only one way in which a man can respond to them: by never relaxing in the search for truth." And that, by and large, is what we've been trying to do in the last 4, 5, 6 weeks. We have been never relaxing in the search for truth. We've read Hans Hermann Hoppe's book, A Theory of Socialism and Capitalism. We've read Mises on economic calculation in the socialist commonwealth and Joseph Salerno's postscript on the same. We've read a handful of old Poppy articles about the effects of capitalism on the environment, on society, on culture. We've explored some of the common objections to the capitalist system. We've read Friedrich Hayek on the use of knowledge in society. We can look back and realize that the world from which we are emerging, the world from which the present is emerging, is at the very least not a world in which global socialism is really that much of a threat. The Berlin Wall came down now over 20 years ago, and now that the wall has come down, and as the specter of communism, which was once haunting Europe, is receding and diminishing, we can at least be optimistic that maybe, just maybe, we won't see something like this happen again. The reason, though, or the only way that we can prevent this from happening again is by following Mises' advice, by never relaxing in the search for truth. Hazlitt said, and I repeat, that the good ideas have to be relearned every single generation. One of the reasons we've had these last 5 or 6 weeks together, one of the reasons I've taught this course, is to reinforce for myself, first of all, what the truth is about economic systems, and then second, to equip you with information about and knowledge of and a command over at least the basic theoretical ideas underlining a liberal capitalist society. So with that, I am finished with what I have to say tonight. The exam, again, should be available within the next several days. You'll get an email when it is. The exam will cover not just the lectures, but also the assigned readings. And I look forward to seeing how you do on all of this. Again, if you need any kind of paperwork signed for taking this for extra credit or something to that effect, again, you know, just let me know. I look forward to hearing from all of you again. Some of you I've met, some of you I haven't, some of you I'll meet for the first time sometime within the next couple of months. If you have any questions at all, just drop me a line, art.cardin@gmail.com, and I'm happy to open it up for questions for the next half an hour, 45 minutes. Okay, so the first question that appeared in the chat box is from Gregor Bruner, who is very, very patient. This came up earlier when we were talking about apologists for socialism and how they might react to the socialist or to the capitalist critique of socialism. And they would argue, well, yes, pure real socialism, pure socialism never really existed. Indeed, one of the arguments I've seen is that the Soviet Union itself represented not a failure of socialism, but another failure of capitalism because for whatever reason it relied on massive capital formation and massive industrial projects. So yes, a lot of people would argue that real pure socialism has never really existed. That's why theory is really important and why theory at the intersection of history is really, really important. Indeed, actually, you know, that might be an idea for you know, if I teach another Mises course within the next year. That might be it. I don't know. I might teach a course on Mises' theory and history. History can at times be seen as a collection of facts, or if you're statistical about it, just a collection of data. And the idea among the German historicists to whom Mises was responding when he was writing early part of the 20th century, and then later when he wrote Theory and History, was, well, what we need to do is collect all of the facts, and then reality will emerge. Then the proper and appropriate interpretation of social reality will emerge from the collection of facts. Well, that's atheoretical. What we need is real, genuine theory if we're going to be able to interpret the facts correctly. So a couple of things, my back-of-the-envelope theory of how to do scholarship. One, use theory to interpret the facts and make sure that the theory is correct. Mises writes on this extensively. The body of economic theory is not empirical. It can be deduced from a simple proposition, which is that man acts. And we can and should use that to interpret the entire world around us. When we want to develop propositions about causal relationships in history, and this falls under the view of empirical economics, Mises would probably not call it economics, he would call it economic history. Going to the facts and going to the data and using the data and the facts properly interpreted can tell us whether X did in fact cause Y at some point in history. Let's see. Okay, would they argue that, real peer socialism never really existed?
Yeah, that would generally be the
claim, but that's not actually an argument. I think that's a dodge. That's to say, oh well, real socialism never existed, therefore socialism can work. Well, no, we've in theory socialism can't work. I mean that's the essence of the Mises and Hayek contribution for the early part of the 20th century. Is even under the most ideal set of circumstances, socialism cannot happen or socialism cannot work. A socialist society can't function as a rational society. Okay. Doug Stewart says, Quest for Cosmic Justice is a phenomenal book. Yes, it is. I should probably read it again. Steve Chipman, are you optimistic about the American economy in the short term and then in the long term? Do you agree with people like Peter Schiff, who seem very pessimistic, at least in the short term? I can sort of tell you what my asset portfolio looks like, and that should tell you about my expectations. I agree with James Buchanan. I'm sort of pessimistic when I look into the future, but I'm very optimistic when I look into the past. Most of our assets are in stocks, things we're planning to – we've pursued a buy-and-hold strategy for the last decade or so, and we're planning to continue down that route. But we have bought a lot of precious metals in the last few years, and our gold holdings, our silver holdings have increased substantially. So I am optimistic – I'm optimistic over the short run and the long run, but I am guarding myself, or we're trying to guard ourselves by actually holding physical precious metals, just in case things go a little bit nuts. About the short term, I honestly really don't know. On one hand, I think American economic growth is not going to be what it could be, and definitely not what it should be, as a result of central bank, as a result of central banking, as a result of government policy, and sort of the standard litany of critiques. But at the same time, the last year? Just over the last year, I've seen the introduction of the iPhone 4, the iPad. The new version of the Amazon Kindle. I mean, you have all sorts of newer, better ways to live your life, and all sorts of ways that I think are ways in which I know my life has been revolutionized in the last in just the last year or so as I've adopted more technology. Exactly what we're doing right now is one of the reasons why I'm very optimistic over the long run. I think this could very well be the Tim Freeburn loves his nuke, or his nook rather. Okay, I consider that perhaps a minor heresy. No, okay, not really. I've heard very good things about the nook. I don't know. Might pick up one eventually. The fact that we have literally an international discussion going on right now about whether we should be pessimistic or optimistic about the American economy, strikes me as a fairly good reason to be optimistic. I don't fear for the death of Western civilization, but I do think that we are going to be a lot poorer over the next 10 years than we would have been without the last decade of war, without central bank manipulation of the money supply, without, again, the entire laundry list of government programs. Let's see here. Jonathan Sleeper asks, do I think that sometimes socialism functions as a substitute for religion for some people? How does that work? Okay, so that's very interesting. And in fact, so Murray Rothbard has a Gregor Bruner says we're just blowing up the ultimate bubble. There's a degree to which that's true. I think higher ed might actually be might be the next bubble to pop, which scares me a little bit. Okay, but yeah, so to answer Jonathan's question, sometimes socialism functions as a substitute for religion. Okay, so I'm a man of faith myself. So I see a lot of parallels between the ideologies people develop, and ironically, the ideologies people develop in the name of being scientific about the world that are nonetheless manifestations of the same impulses that drive people toward faith, that drive people toward religion, that drive people toward what have you. Socialism, I think, is very much the same thing. There are some important parallels between socialist eschatology and Christian eschatology. Excuse me. Murray Rothbard has a great article called Karl Marx, Communist as Religious Eschatologist. And the idea that someday we will, you know, come the revolution, or come the second coming of Christ, or come this, or come that, or come the other thing, we will attain our full humanity, history will end, and it will be paradise from there on out. There are definite parallels between that aspect of the Christian tradition and what Marx is writing. And indeed, Marx himself spent an awful lot of time studying theology. I do think in the case of socialism functioning as a religion, I think it's definitely a type of secular religion. It is its modern manifestation, I think, is the environmental movement. I reviewed, for the latest issue of the Freeman, I reviewed Robert Nelson's book, The New Holy, which I'm trying to get the title off my bookshelf, The New Holy Wars, Economic Religion versus Environmental Religion in Contemporary America. And he points out that a lot of this that's masquerading as science in the environmental movement is, in fact, has its roots in the same sort of impulses that we associate with religion. That I think actually could be another interesting Mises Academy course. I think would be economics and religion, or economics and faith. What I see is the long-term impact of exploding national debt. Do I see significant inflation brewing? Long-term impact of exploding national debt. Countries have had huge debts in the past, and they've still grown. So I don't think the national debt is going to be nearly as bad as some people think. I mean, I don't think it's going to cause the disintegration of Western society. But again, I think the people, so Steve Horowitz and I have a couple of articles about the Tea Party movement, in which we point out that a lot of the people who are protesting higher taxes or who are protesting government spending are not idiots, because they realize that their kids are likely to be better off than we are. My kids are likely to be better off than I am. And by spending as much money as we are right now, what we're doing is we're literally taxing our children. Stephen Landsberg makes a number of very good points in which he says, he applies a notion that we call Ricardian equivalence, in which he points out that the real burden of government is not taxation, it's spending. Because when governments spend, they consume real resources. So they can either pay for it with taxes, in which case money's taken out of my pocket right now to pay for the pay for current spending, or they can pay for it with debt, in which case they'll tax my kids someday to pay for it all. The two things are equivalent, though, because when they tax me, that diminishes the value of my assets and reduces what I can pass on to the next generation. So the net macroeconomic effects should basically be the same. Do I see significant inflation brewing? I don't actually know I'm not really sure what you mean by significant. I think inflation is definitely going to take place, but I was thinking about this morning as I was pouring orange juice. I think inflation is not necessarily going to manifest itself in prices on grocery store shelves for the following reason. There are a lot of different margins on which you can change a good. So I'm pouring orange juice, and you've probably seen people talk about how companies are very subtly shrinking the packages of the goods that they're selling. So they might sell, if you bought ice cream recently, you've probably seen you get like a quart and a half for what you used to pay for two quarts. Or you might get 52 ounces of juice or 60 ounces of juice for the same price you used to pay for 64. Printed on the carton was still 64 fluid ounces. Okay, great. It's wonderful. I'm getting 64 fluid ounces of juice. I'm not getting hammered by the grocer, and I'm not experiencing I'm not experiencing all of the negative effects of inflation. The problem, though, is I think a lot of the effects of inflation over the next few years are going to come on margins that are difficult to measure, specifically quality. Yes, my tub of, or my carton of orange juice still has 64 fluid ounces of juice in it, But my guess is that that's probably a little bit more, that there's a little bit more water in there than there used to be. Or it was made with slightly lower quality oranges. Or this long list of things you can think about, ways in which we can change the physical characteristics of goods without actually changing the money price, without actually changing the sticker price. So you provide a slightly different good and you charge the same price for it. That's one of the effects of inflation, is quality erosion. I don't know if anybody has talked about that in the professional literature. I think Steve Horowitz, again, has a couple of really neat posts about this coordination problem. But this sort of steady erosion of quality is where I think inflation is ultimately going to manifest itself. Okay, let's see here. Okay, so Evan asks, any thought on a good BA or master's programs in preparation for an eventual PhD for someone considering a career switch into Austrian economics? Red Block's suggestions haven't seen much direction for undergrad. I already have a bachelor's in computer science, so if you make the choice to make a switch, aim for an accelerated program, you get a BA in 1 or 2 years if that makes a difference. Well, I'm at Rhodes College, obviously. I think that's where, and I say that somewhat tongue-in-cheek, because that's where I am, and because I want to attract great students. But I'm also maybe sort of a little bit serious, because we now have at Rhodes a new program in political economy that draws from economics, political science, philosophy, international studies, history. The English department is offering a course. The anthropology and sociology department is offering a course. It's a perfect liberal arts major. And it is, I mean, it's really going to be something else. My goal for this program is I want Rhodes to be the best place in the world to study political economy, the undergraduate level, you know, within, say, the next 20 years or something like that. And I think that might very well be doable. If not Rhodes, because I don't really know that we can do accelerated programs like what you're talking about, pretty much any state university will probably be able to match you with what you want to do. You can get an economics degree and read on the side and then go to graduate school. For a PhD, the school you obviously want to go to, I think, is George Mason. Suffolk University in Boston is developing a great program. West Virginia University has had good programs in the past. George Selgin at the University of Georgia, I think, is still supervising dissertations. Let's see, other undergraduate places you might want to go. San Jose State, you might want to look at as well. They have a very solid group there. And then, of course, Loyola University in New Orleans. Hillsdale College, of course, has a very solid Austrian program. There are a lot of good places to go. I would encourage you to look again at Walter's stuff, and also the Foundation for Economic Education has started putting out. They've only done a couple of these, but they're putting out summaries of undergraduate institutions that are very strong in free market economics. Florida Gulf Coast University, for example. I think they want to do one on Rhodes eventually, which we can do now that we have the program in political economy. But yeah, there are a lot of great places to go. To get an accelerated program, given that you already have a degree, again, I don't know how liberal arts colleges are going to handle that. But most state universities should be able to handle that without a problem. What happens to inflation if the world goes off the petrodollar? Honestly, no idea. That's way outside my area of expertise. So my apologies. Okay, so Doug Stewart's right, Grove City. But my apologies to Tom for that not being part of my just that being outside of my area of expertise. Okay, so Grove City College, also another place to look at. Sean Rittenour, Jeffrey Herbner are very good. Let's see. Graduate programs online or undergrad online. So I think that things like this are going to, these are going to gain more currency in the mainstream. Graduate programs online, I honestly don't know that we will see within the next 10 years graduate programs online that are taken seriously, quite honestly. If I were evaluating application for a position at Rhodes, I saw that someone had a PhD from an online institution, that they would not be considered any further. I think for undergraduate, I really don't know. that's, I think things like that are going to change. I think a lot of online ed might go more toward technical education and things like that. But I graduate programs online, I would not. Or if you're getting a professional degree, then you might as well go and do that. But you're not going to get into academia with an online graduate degree, and probably not even with an online undergrad degree, because I really doubt that PhD granting institutions are going to accept online degrees as legitimate. That's an unfortunate but sad reality, I think. How in the world would the Fed be able to tighten without completely collapsing the economy? Oh my goodness, how can the Fed tighten without completely collapsing the economy? Okay, so first of all, this is kind of a pet peeve of mine. Is Fed is not an acronym. The contraction Fed is F, is usually capital F, lowercase e, lowercase d. As a matter of rhetorical strategy. I would drop the use of capitalized FED, because even people with whom you disagree are likely to get very, very defensive about that. Again, I'm not really sure that's fair, but that I think is kind of the reality of the world in which we live. How in the world would the Fed be able to tighten without completely collapsing the economy? That's a great question, and I don't know. I think if the Fed eased back on the monetary accelerator, that obviously is probably going to create a lot of short-term pain as people recalculate and reallocate resources. I really don't know that there's a way for the Fed to stop doing what it's doing without creating at least some serious tensions. And this gets outside of pure economics, because we can argue, well, the Fed should just quit printing money, and then yes, there will be this painful readjustment, but resources will be reallocated to their highest value uses, and then things will go on. But here I speculate, if you get the kind of effects that would happen from the Fed tightening completely, or from the Fed just closing the doors, you might actually see revolution in the streets. There, I don't really know. You might see a takeover. Socialism might become even more popular as a working people's movement again. And parenthetically, it's important to note, and you will need to know this for the exam, that socialism was never a movement from the ground up. It was always a movement from the intellectuals downward. But we might see people get enthusiastic about socialism again, because the collapse of the world economy, or the collapse of even the domestic economy, would be seen as a failure of laissez-faire, unregulated capitalism, as these things tend to be. As I'm not a macroeconomic theorist, and quite honestly, this is one thing I'm learning. I'm learning as an economist is I can speak. I could teach anything in the undergraduate curriculum, obviously. But when it comes to macro, for very, very fine questions, like sort of the state of the art on the literature on the Fed, I'm not as qualified to answer as, say, someone like Steve Horowitz, Larry White, George Selgin, Joe Salerno. In fact, Salerno has, on Mises.org, I'm pretty sure you need audio or video, at least, of a lecture in which Salerno talks about the mechanics of going back on the gold standard. So I think that we, and I'll preface this by saying I think we should totally go back on gold. But I'm a little bit less optimistic about the ability to do that as a very smooth political transition, or as part of a smooth political transition. Let's see. Okay, how is the Federal Reserve monetizing the debt any different from the Weimar Republic monetizing their debt? Other than ours is measured in the trillions, and theirs were in billions. Hyperinflation resulted in the Weimar case. Why would ours also result in hyperinflation? Quite honestly, there's the view that the central bank in the United States at least knows what it's doing, and that it is not, in fact, trying specifically to inflate away debt. That it's engaged in monetary policy for purposes of managing the macroeconomy, not for purposes of eliminating debt using paper money. So a lot of that is perceptions based. It's there's a lot of psychology to it. Okay, so Gregor says, do the Chinese relating to the U.S. if they stop? I think it will be just like the Weimar Republic. That's an interesting thesis, and I know the way that we're allocating our assets at home doesn't suggest a future of hyperinflation, but it's a sort of thing that could very well be possible. Any favorite economist or non-economist among the 19th century classical liberals? Yes, Frederick Bastiat, one of the greatest writers ever, I think, and unfortunately received short shrift as an economist, but he was unbelievable. 19th century classical liberals, I've definitely put Menger in there. He's one of them. This guy, Eugen Boom Boom Bobbert. I wore this because I had a review session for my Econ 100 class today, and no one showed up, which I thought was a little bit interesting because they have an exam tomorrow morning at 8:30. So I'm hoping that their apparent confidence is consistent with their actual preparation for the exam. 19th century classical liberals, Jean-Baptiste Say. Is another one, but I really like Bastiat a lot as an economic communicator because, first of all, he had some real serious genuine insights, that which is seen and that which is not seen, and then also his ability to take clear and careful economic principles and turn them in and illustrate the absurdity of a lot of politics was, I think, unrivaled for his day. The Candlemaker's Petition, I think, is absolutely fantastic. He basically, if you're not familiar with the Candlemaker's Petition, I would take a look at it, or I would look it up, and the basic thrust of it is it's a petition from the Candlemakers saying we need to block out the sun. We need to mandate that people sit inside all day with their doors and windows closed. That way we'll sell more candles. That way the French will become wealthier. Let me think. Other 19th century liberals. Well, Eugene Richter, author of Pictures of the Socialist Future, I think he's a clear candidate. I think that was originally published in 1895. So if it was, then yes, I would count him as a 19th century liberal. If not, then I wouldn't. Obviously, Cobden and Bright and everyone who brought about the repeal of the Corn Laws in England would definitely be among that number. But I think. I think Bastiat sort of stands head and shoulders above the rest. Let's see here. Okay, what do I think about Milton Friedman? I think Milton Friedman, and here I don't think that we do any good for the cause of liberty by beating up on Milton Friedman. Quite honestly, I fail to see how that's a useful exercise. I think Friedman obviously was not an anarchist, and I think was more sanguine about the state than I am certainly, but he really was in the late 20th century, the picture of the public face of liberty. In his work on central banking, I think his view of the necessity of fiat money, I think, is fundamentally flawed. And I know that there are a lot of people who would there are a lot of people who would agree with that. But Friedman made a lot of very, very important contributions to the policy side of these debates and these discussions by showing that the positive relationship between inflation and unemployment that was so popular among the Keynesians didn't exist. That the economy probably had a natural rate of unemployment, and that printing money ultimately led not to additional output, but to bigger business cycles, or excuse me, to inflation. Friedman said, inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. Any American male who is between the ages of 18 and 25 owes Milton Friedman a great debt of gratitude for being at the forefront of the intellectual revolution, or excuse me, the forefront of the intellectual critique of the draft. So we have Friedman to thank for getting rid of the draft, and we have Friedman to thank, I think, in part for popularizing liberal policies in at least some respect, and in at least some places. I mean, he was, I think, a staunch and ardent defender of liberty in a lot of different margins, and one of the great defenders of the free market of the last 40 or 50 years, 50, 60. Good Lord, man. Yeah, 50, 60 years. His autobiography is a very interesting read. I read it for a paper that, actually a couple of papers that Robert Lawson, well, one that Robert Lawson and I wrote, and another that actually ended up published in the Journal of Lutheran Ethics. It was a review essay on Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine. And then Lawson and I wrote a paper on human rights and economic liberalization. If you're familiar with Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, she basically blames Milton Friedman for the human rights abuses that took place in Latin America and around the world from roughly the death of Salvador Allende in the early 1970s through even today. I mean, it's an absolutely ridiculous thesis. But anything that is good economically that's going on in Latin America, and I'm thinking very specifically about Chile, that opens itself to the intellectual legacy of Milton Friedman. Again, like I said, he was a staunch defender of liberty. From a practical perspective, I think what he had to say about central banking was definitely worth listening to, given that the world had central banks, and given that get rid of the central banks is not on the table. I think there's a lot to be said in Friedman's defense. Let's see here. Okay, free market economics and anti-war. Yep. Okay. Often speak with people who've gone through years of brain training with evil executives. Has to be bullied by good bureaucrats so that the little people get a bit of money, idea which probably appeals to the laziness of many. Without wanting to play the same brainwashing game, what in your mind is the most efficient way to help people wake up from this idea? Okay, so yeah, so this is something that I find very frustrating. At times when I sit at lunch at the cafeteria here at Rhodes, and I worry that I come across as an ideologue or a zealot, because there are things like because there are things that economists just know. I mean, with a capital K, we know comparative advantage, supply and demand, minimum wages create job losses, people respond to incentives, all of this stuff. And there are a lot of other people, and indeed people that I spend a lot of time with as colleagues, who just don't know any of this stuff because their field of specialization is something other than economics. The most efficient way to help people wake up from this idea, first, never relax in the search for truth, and second, I think, try to develop as a writer. I'm not exactly sure how that should manifest itself in everybody's life, but I would like to see more good, solid commentary. Better blog comments, I think, would be a first thing that's worth thinking about. Better letters to the editor of newspapers, better op-ed columns. Again, if you're a student and you have the opportunity to write an op-ed column for your campus newspaper, give it a go. Assume and here I would definitely read Hayek's Intellectuals and Socialism again very, very carefully, because most of the people who become socialists or most of the people who become interventionists, you know, they do so with very, very good intentions. Yeah, you know, I don't know anybody on campus who is an interventionist who is also evil, as far as I can tell. You know, the people I hang out with at lunch are very, very nice people who want the best for the world in which we live. They just happen to not really know a whole lot about economics. So drop the assumption that the only people who disagree with you are either evil or stupid, and then try to find venues in which you can try to advance these ideas. Again, newspapers are always looking for good letters to the editor. Campus newspapers, I know, are always looking for good columns. If you can find if you get together with some people and start a good blog, or even if you don't feel like you have the credibility to start a blog, you become a good commentator, or become a good commenter on the Mises blog or something like that. Find ways to advance the discussion. Find ways to refine and hone your arguments. And that's what I would recommend. I give people a lot of books. I give away a lot of books. Economics in One Lesson is great. Atlas Shrugged is great to a degree. But yeah, find a handful of cheap books. Somebody you can have on hand. The Mises Institute made a little pamphlet out of chapter 38, I think, of Human Action. It's titled The Place of Economics in Learning. That I think would be kind of a good tract or something to have on hand. Those go for like $2 a piece. If you want to be evangelical about it. But yeah, I think engaging the arguments and doing so as civilized people who are earnestly contending for the truth is the best way to proceed. What is the libertarian view on delicate things like abortion, separation of church and state, gay rights, etc.? Okay, so Economic and Lesson content. Thanks for an excellent gift. The title makes it feel very arrogant and condescending. Yeah, okay, there's a degree to which that's true. I think, though, that it is kind of an excellent book to have on hand. Manuel Ayu, who helped to found the Universidad Francisco Marroquín in Guatemala, has a neat little book called Not a Zero-Sum Game that's about international trade. That also might be something that would be good to have on hand. But, okay, libertarian view on delicate things like abortion, economics for experts, or something. Okay, clever. On this theme, I have a lot of ideas for books that I want to write someday or papers I want to write someday. I have a very rough draft of a manuscript that's been sitting on my shelf forever. It's basically a lot of my old Mises columns and a handful of other things, tentatively titled Guerrilla Economics. I want to finish that. I also want to write a book that would be kind of like Economics for Experts that would be titled something like Against Folk Economics. It'd be like an economic perspective on the things you know that just ain't so. If we can borrow from Mark Twain on that. But again, these are projects for the very, very long run. Okay, so let's talk about light topics like abortion, separation of church and state, and gay rights. Okay, these are really, really interesting. Because first, I have personal views on some of these issues. I'm absolutely anti-abortion. I cannot conceive of a system of morality in which that is conceived of as an okay thing to do to another human being. I just flat out can't comprehend it. That does not mean necessarily that the damage associated with abortion can be minimized by state action. And I think a lot of people who are anti-abortion I don't know if I want to say wasting their time and energy, but that might be the best way to put it, by petitioning for overturn of Roe v. Wade, or by petitioning for laws to regulate abortion clinics, or by petitioning for laws against abortion. Because first of all, doing that, making it more difficult for people to get abortions it'll shift the abortion market overseas. You'll have abortion tourism, and you might actually make the problem worse than it would be before the set of interventions. So I'm not sure if that's really the right way to proceed, or if the people who are so vigorously anti-abortion should be looking for ways to help provide alternatives. Like, for example, I'm of the view that there should be a free market in parental rights. Brian Kaplan has written a couple of neat things about this. I think if you do that, you almost get rid of abortion overnight. ways to provide alternatives, I think would be appropriate. The libertarian views, there's not the libertarian view, I think, on abortion. I think that an infant, whether it's been born or not, has all of the rights associated with being a human being. Walter Block made what I think is a great argument in the, it was 2000 or 2001. He argued in a lecture that he gave at, I think it was the Austrian Scholars Conference, that abortion is permissible in the libertarian world because it is the least invasive way of ridding a woman of an uninvited trespasser, in a sense. So anyway, look up Block on that, because we only have a couple of minutes left. There's no one libertarian view on this. But I do think that there are alternatives, obviously alternatives, to making it illegal. And I think that pursuing a lot of those alternatives would probably be a much better way to proceed. Let's see here. So separation of church and state, gay rights. I think the libertarian principle of non-aggression against non-aggressors carries through on pretty much all of this. Let's see. So gay rights. I have no problem whatsoever with homosexuals entering into a covenant and calling it marriage. I have no problem with gay marriage. I think that's there's no reason for the state to restrict that. Church and state. In the context of a very specific example. I'm sort of the view that the separation of church and state is there to protect faith from being corrupted by power, rather than to prevent the state from being corrupted by the church. I was really horrified, honestly, last summer when I saw the degree to which people were willing to trample over private property rights and trample on the First Amendment protection of the right to freedom of religion in order to basically implore the government to shut down the mosque that the Cordoba Initiative at the time was trying to build a couple of blocks away from the World Trade Center. I'm for separation of state and everything, honestly. But I'm definitely not of the view of the state that it is the state's prerogative to enforce morality. View of Rand's philosophy of objectivism. Have I seen the movie of Atlas Shrugged? No, I have not. My wife and I are hoping to see that next week. Objectivism, I think it's really interesting because I'm a huge fan of Rand. And I think she gets a lot of great things right. I think what she talks about the nature of man and production and creation of values and all of this, I have a lot of sympathies with objectivism, but I'm obviously not an atheist. And I think that is Rand's greatest weakness is her sort of offhand dismissal of theological arguments and evidence. One of the things I like so much about Atlas Shrugged as a book is it's a direct application in a fictional context of a lot of things that I teach in Econ 100, and it's powerful and it's gripping in exactly the right places. Let's see here. Mises, of course, and Adam Smith. Okay, that could be interesting. I teach a course at Rhodes called Classical and Marxian Political Economy. We read Parts of Wealth of Nations. The person to look up on that is a philosopher at Yeshiva University in New York named James Otteson. He is actually the guy from whom a lot of what I know about Smith I've learned from hanging out with Jim. And indeed, his book, Adam Smith's Marketplace of Life, is one that I have in fact lent to a student for the summer. And I think it's something you should put on your Amazon wish list. Jim is a trained philosopher. He's not a quote Austrian economist or anything like that. But yeah, I think a Mises course on Adam Smith would be really, really interesting. It is 7:30 by my clock, so I'm happy to take one more question if anybody has one. Otherwise, we will Otherwise, we will dismiss, and we will call it a course. I will get the be on the lookout for another question to come by. Like I said, I will be in touch, or I'll send a copy of the exam to Danny, and it should be available online very, very soon. We'll open it. It should stay open for about a week. I'll provide instructions for it. And again, if you need any kind of paperwork or anything like that, just let me know. You've been a fantastic audience. I've really enjoyed doing this. It's been an incredible experience for me. It's interesting to see how the world's changing. And again, I hope some of you I know virtually. Some of you I have met face to face, I think. And those of you that I don't know, I look forward to our paths crossing before terribly long. So I'm going to sign off. Thank you again. And those of you I have not yet met, I look forward to seeing you in the real world.